Okay.
These are the sounds of space. They are almost commonplace now. It seems like a long time ago that it all began. In many ways, it seems like yesterday. How did it begin? It wasn't until World War II and the German bombardment of London that we began to realize the true potential of long-range rocketry. The technology required was far beyond anything we had known in the past. We quickly outgrew the limits of the early proving grounds like White Sands in the New Mexico desert. And in the late 1940s, a group of military leaders got together to begin the project that was to become the Air Force Eastern Test Range. They looked at the coasts of Texas and Florida and finally settled on a deserted sand spit jutting out into the Atlantic from Florida's east coast. This nearly uninhabited scrubland called Cape Canaveral was to become the most famous dateline of all time. It had many natural advantages. It was separated from the mainland by the Banana River and the Indian River, a natural buffer between the often unpredictable early rockets and the towns along the mainland shore. There was a clear expanse of water stretching southwestward all the way to the coast of Africa, and it was dotted along the way with islands for the tracking stations. The range was conceived as a national resource to be managed by the Air Force, but for the use of agencies in this country and throughout the free world. There have been some exciting times at the Cape. The flight of the first American in space, Commander Alan Shepard's suborbital rocket ride 300 miles down the eastern test range.
T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. Ignition.
Ignition.
Oh, roger. Lift off and the clock has started.
There is flame underneath the bird. He is alive and lifting, and there goes the red star. He's going. Please. Just as good as can be. There is a smart burst of fire underneath, shockwave streaming from underneath the rocket, lifting as cleanly and perfectly as we ever hoped he would go. This is it, astronaut Shepard. Good luck from every one of us here on a Cape. He's climbing clean and straight. Go, baby! He is climbing as good as you ever want. He's picking up acceleration. He is now being squeezed out. That's it. Vapor coming up the side of the bird. Going through some clouds. Momentarily out of sight there. He comes back again. The redstone is going straight up. Going up beautifully so far.
The range was here a long time before the Shepard flight, though. The world's largest shooting gallery became a reality 20 years ago on the 1st of October, 1949. 9 months later, the first missile launched from Cape Canaveral officially christened what was then called the Joint Long-Range Proving Ground. The flight of the captured German V-2 with a WAC corporal upper stage was a complete success. It traveled all of 190 miles. Throughout the 50s, the major efforts were in two directions, the air-breathing pilotless bomber and the new weapon with a terrifying potential for destruction or peace, the ballistic missile. The early pilotless bombers, or cruise missiles as they were called, were intercontinental in range but limited to the altitudes and speeds of the higher performance aircraft of the day. They had picturesque names, Lark and Snark, Matador, Navajo, and Mace. But they were outmoded almost as soon as they were developed. The ballistic missile was a quantum jump in weapons technology. No defense was possible against it. But there were major technological problems that had yet to be overcome. They came to the range to test. Redstone, Jupiter, and Thor. Atlas, Titan, and Minuteman. There were frustrating times. Booster after booster blew up on the pad. Others went wild and had to be destroyed in flight. It was a time of learning. And there were good times, too. The frantic, frustrating rush to duplicate Russia's Sputnik and its culmination, the launch of our first Earth satellite, Explorer 1.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. Ignition. Separating.
In the middle 50s, the Cape was a far cry from the sophistication of today. General Bernard Schriever recalls some of the early problems in the Atlas test program.
In 1955, I brought a group of officers here that presented to the base our requirements for facilities for the ICBM program. The people here were absolutely shocked. We said we needed 4 Atlas test facilities, that we needed a complete redo of the downrange instrumentation to accommodate the ballistic missile program. I went out on the Cape and I saw one stand out there, which I'll always remember. This was the Navajo pad. The Navajo pad looked to me like the greatest hunk of concrete that I'd ever seen in my life. And I said, by God, there'll never be any white elephants around here like that if I have anything to do with it. Well, you can barely see the Navajo pad among the scrub there. I think the concrete is still standing, but you see the facilities that were built for the Thor, the Atlas, the Titan, and now look at the facilities for Titan III, and I spent the morning looking at the Apollo facilities, and it's absolutely fantastic what has happened in the very short period of years since 1955 that I stood on the Cape looking at where we were to place our ballistic missile facilities.
Atlas was the big missile. By November of 1958, it had proven its ability to deliver a warhead on target 5,000 miles away. While the first priority was given to developing Atlas as a weapon system, its potential as a space booster was not overlooked. The first orbital flight of the Atlas was the most spectacular event in the space program up to that time. The entire Atlas booster, big as a truck and far bigger than anything ever placed into orbit before, carried President Eisenhower's 1958 Christmas message to the world.
This is the President of the United States speaking. Through the marvels of scientific advance, my voice is coming to you from a satellite circling in outer space. Through this unique means, I convey to you and to all mankind America's wish for peace on Earth and goodwill toward men everywhere.
Project SCORE, as it was called, was not a publicity stunt. It proved many things. The feasibility of the communication satellites that allow us to watch by television events around the world as they happen. It paved the way for our Man in Space program. Colonel Asa Gibbs, the project officer, talks about Project SCORE and the potential for the Atlas booster.
SCORE did several things. One, it showed that we could transmit to and from an object orbiting in space. It also showed that we could put an Atlas missile in orbit. And since this was the B series of the Atlas missile, by some extrapolation of increased thrust and capability, we knew that we were eventually going to be able to put a man in orbit.
The potential was fulfilled when an Air Force launched Atlas boosted Colonel John Glenn into orbit on his historic 3-revolution flight through space.
Godspeed, John Glenn. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Roger, the clock is operating. We're underway.
You're loud and clear.
Roger, we're programming and roll okay. A little bumpy along about here.
Roger. Stand by for 20 seconds.
Roger.
2, 1, mark.
Roger, backup clock is started.
Even though Cape Kennedy is part of the Air Force Eastern Test Range, the range itself does not launch any missiles. It supports missile tests by range users. Support ranges from logistics operations such as security, maintenance, fuel analysis, and the like, to flight support, with a collection of radar, telemetry, and optical data, feeding real-time data to the range user, allowing him to make split-second decisions that are sometimes necessary. After the flight, the range provides the user with a final report on the performance of the missile throughout its flight, an invaluable aid in a research and development program. Though the range has grown over the past 20 years, both physically and in the sophistication of its operation, its mission remains the same: to ensure that this nation stands first in space. From the V-2 to the moon landing. The Air Force Eastern Test Range has pointed the way of the future, the first step on the stairway to the stars.